Today is Monday, January 25th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. What's the broader impact after thousands protested in Moscow over the detention of Russian critic Alexei Navalny?
It's hard to imagine them kind of folding to Russian, to Western pressure at this point, but we'll just have to see.
Plus, as President Donald Trump's second impeachment trial nears, what other legal issues is he facing?
There are a blizzard of ongoing investigations and potential civil and criminal actions against the president.
We'll have these stories and more next. Hundreds of people remained behind bars in Russia on Sunday, a day after they were arrested for joining nationwide street protests demanding the release of jailed opposition leader Alexei Navalny. Reporter Charles Maines is in Moscow, and he gave me the details.
For starters, I was at the event here in Moscow. There's a protest at Pushkin Square, which is in central Moscow, not too far from the Kremlin. We saw the square itself overflowing. That's several thousand people, probably 5,000-6,000 people. But more importantly, the side streets were overflowing. There had been some debate here in terms of the numbers of the turnout, but it was significant. I mean, you look around, you talk to people, and some were there to support Navalny and demanding his freedom. That seemed to be, of course, the main crux of the protest. But other people saying that they were just fed up with, having one president essentially for their whole lives, because Navalny's approach and his reach really has been primarily the candidate in some ways of younger Russians. So a lot of people in their 20s, even some high schoolers there, which of course the Kremlin has pointed to is a sign that Navalny is trying to kind of lure underage people into harm's way. The police presence was very heavy. We saw over 3,000 arrests, which is remarkable. But the other thing I want to point out, Steve, is that we had also beyond Moscow, there were protests across the country, which really, everywhere from in the Far East, in places like Vladivostok, to the north, the far north in the Arctic Circle, where places like Irkutsk, where it was minus 50 degrees Celsius, and yet people were out. And this just gives a sense that Navalny has this national reach.
You mentioned the effort to minimize his impact, but by bringing so many people out, even in temperatures as low as minus 50 centigrade, what kind of impact is his call having on the nation?
Well, first of all, I think there's a sense that people have rallied around Navalny's case to express dissatisfaction with the Kremlin itself. I mean, it's almost like Navalny has kind of forced this kind of binary sort of decision among people. You're either for the Kremlin or you're for Navalny. And before, there was more of kind of a gray area between the two. But I think in some ways, this story of him being poisoned last August, recuperating abroad after being flown there in a coma, then coming back to Russia and having the authorities not investigate the poisoning, but investigate him for parole violations and perhaps other violations that may send him to jail for several years, that somehow kind of lifted the veil on any assumptions that somehow maybe he had different agendas. And we've seen the Kremlin certainly try and portray Navalny's return as a Western-backed plot to try and destroy Russia from within, with influence from the U.S. in particular, I should add. Or perhaps it's just an attempt to kind of Navalny has his own strategies, but he's got other agendas.
One last question here. There have been calls for the release of Navalny by several governments around the world. There's been condemnation, at least here in the United States, against the crackdown by Russian authorities to those who came out and protesting. What's been the response overall to the controversy from the Russian government?
So it's a great question about international pressure. We've seen, as U.S. And much of Western Europe condemn this behavior against Navalny by the Russian government. The question is what impact it can have. The U.S. has already sanctioned Russia over many issues, including its behavior in Ukraine, including allegations of interference in the U.S. elections back in 2016 and other things. So I think there's a sense from the Russian government, their response is that this is, first of all, an internal Russian issue. They've told essentially the rest of the world to butt out. It's a law enforcement issue in their mind. And it also they've also painted this, and this is important, as essentially Western governments trying to interfere in internal Russian affairs to try and sort of support Navalny and create a revolution here within Russia. So it's hard to imagine them kind of folding to Western pressure at this point, but we'll just have to see.
Charles Maines reports from Moscow. United Nations officials are expressing alarm over worsening security at the Al-Hol refugee camp in northeast Syria. this after multiple murders between January 1st and January 16th. Lisa Schlein has those details.
Fears for the safety and protection of camp residents and humanitarian workers are growing following the murder of 12 Syrian and Iraqi residents, including one female Iraqi refugee. Another person was critically injured during a violent attack. Al-Hol, which is controlled by U.S.-backed Kurdish forces, is the largest camp for refugees and Syrians who have fled their homes, with nearly 62,000 residents. Most are women and children of Syrian and Iraqi origin. They fled to the camp after a U.S.-led coalition ousted Islamic State militants from their stronghold in the northern city of Raqqa in 2018. The U.N. Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs laments the tragic loss of life in Al-Hol. OCHA spokesman Jens Lajerke says the recent rise in violence also threatens the security and the ability of aid workers to provide crucial assistance to the residents.
What they are delivering is primary health care, water, shelter, non-food items, food and hygiene distribution, nutrition, and protection. All of that delivery is being thrown into jeopardy when the level of insecurity rises to what we have seen now.
UNICEF says 14% of camp residents are women and children from 60 countries. They include family members of former IS fighters, as well as their supporters and victims. They're being kept in a separate guarded section for their safety. Lajerke says foreign governments are reluctant to repatriate their nationals because of their relationship with the former militants. He says the UN is calling on governments to treat the many thousands of children trapped in Al-Hol as children and do what is in their best interest.
I don't think anybody can be in doubt that it's not in their best interest to be stuck in this camp for years on end. So repatriation of not least particularly children would be most welcome.
UN officials say the safety and well-being of people at Al-Hol is of utmost importance. They urge greater protection for the camp residents and for humanitarian workers. They note the current situation is not sustainable and durable solutions for all people in the camp must be found. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Gunmen in Mali killed at least six soldiers and wounded 18 others and two coordinated attacks in the center of the African nation on Sunday morning. An army spokesman said the attacks occurred around 0300 UTC in the villages of Bokesi and Mondoro in the Mopti region, sparking a gunfight between the armed group and the army. About 30 assailants were killed, but it's unclear who carried out the attacks. Mali's central and northern regions have for years been home to militant groups with links to both Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State group. They control large areas of the remote desert and regularly carry out raids on the army and civilians. Across Israel, police clashed on Sunday with ultra-Orthodox Jews who violated coronavirus lockdown rules by opening schools and religious seminaries. Despite an impressive vaccine rollout, Israel is in the midst of a third lockdown to try and stop the growing number of cases. Today in Israel, the ultra-Orthodox account for about 40% of new cases. Linda Gradstein takes it from here.
In the ultra-Orthodox neighborhood of Mea Shaarim, hundreds of men clashed with police who attempted to shut down a yeshiva or religious seminary that had opened illegally. The demonstrators insulted the officers, called them Nazis, and threw garbage at them. In the southern city of Ashdod, similar demonstrations left four officers wounded when they closed down an ultra-Orthodox elementary school that had reopened. And in the city of B'nai Brak, a mob surrounded a police officer and threw rocks at him. He fired into the air, saying he believed his life was in danger. According to Israel's lockdown rules, all schools are supposed to be closed and classes held virtually on Zoom. Synagogues are supposed to be closed as well, and gatherings limited to fewer than 10 people. Many Israelis are angry that some of the ultra-Orthodox, who make up about 12% of the Israeli population, but 40% of the new coronavirus cases, have been flouting the rules. They have kept many of their schools and synagogues open and even had large gatherings for weddings or funerals. Rabbi Eliezer Simcha Weitz told Israel Radio that some members of the insular community believe they are being targeted unfairly.
And yet, in the small Haredi communities, many of them just don't know what it's all about. They don't read newspapers, they don't have connections with the internet, and they don't have the outside world to, and they don't know, and they think that they are being attacked and that people are dying and they are not being treated properly.
He said that ultra-Orthodox are suffering even more than other Israelis from the current lockdown, as families with 10 or 12 children are confined to small apartments. They cannot do online schooling, as most do not have internet connections. The ultra-Orthodox violations are not new. They happened during the previous lockdowns as well. But media reports said there was an unspoken agreement that police would not impose the lockdown as long as the ultra-Orthodox did not attack them. But the growing number of cases in the community as well as the recent violence have changed the equation. Many in Israel say that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is being lenient on the community for political reasons. Israel is headed to its fourth election in under 2 years in March, and Netanyahu needs the ultra-Orthodox to help him maintain power. Netanyahu's disaffected coalition partner, Defense Minister Benny Gantz, said the favoritism has to stop. He said there must be equal enforcement of the law and that Israel must give the police the tools to enforce the lockdown. Outside of the ultra-Orthodox community, Israel's high infection rate is starting to come down. But unless they follow the rules, the number of cases in the ultra-Orthodox community is expected to increase. Outside of the ultra-Orthodox community, Israel's high infection rate is starting to come down. But unless they follow the rules, the number of cases in the ultra-Orthodox community is expected to increase. Israel currently has close to 600,000 confirmed infections and more than 4,300 deaths from the virus that causes the COVID-19 disease. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
After months of high seas tensions with Turkish and Greek warships facing off against one another over territorial disputes, the two nations now are set to resume talks on Monday after a nearly five-year hiatus. Some see the negotiations as a huge compromise, but others remain hopeful that the exploratory talks will help Turkey and Greece walk back from the current tense situation. The outcome of Monday's talks could well have consequences not only for Turkish-Greek ties, but also for Turkey's broader relations with its Western allies. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The world is on the verge of reaching 100 million COVID-19 infections. That's according to Johns Hopkins Coronavirus Resource Center statistics, and more than 2 million people have died from the virus. India has begun sending COVID-19 vaccines to neighboring countries as its level of vaccine production has put it at the forefront of suppliers of affordable vaccines to low- and middle-income nations urgently seeking supplies. As Anjana Pasricha reports, India hopes to both raise its global profile with vaccine diplomacy and win back influence in South Asia, where China has been making inroads.
This is the most precious medical cargo for countries waiting to launch COVID-19 immunization programs. Vaccines. Days after rolling out a nationwide inoculation program, India, the world's biggest vaccine producer, donated millions of doses of the British-developed AstraZeneca vaccine to Nepal, Bangladesh, Bhutan, the Maldives, Seychelles, Mauritius, and Myanmar. The affordable and easily storable vaccine being made by an Indian company in partnership with AstraZeneca is in huge demand in developing countries. The goodwill gesture won praise from neighbors such as Bangladesh.
A friend in need is a friend indeed.
Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi has emphasized that neighboring countries will be prioritized in the distribution of vaccine supplies. The initiative is called Vaccine Friendship. The vaccine diplomacy, say analysts, is a means to push back against China, which has been expanding its influence in South Asia. While China is also giving its vaccine to several countries, such as Turkey, South Asian countries had sought supplies of the AstraZeneca vaccine developed in Britain.
India will want to make a point here that in this area, unlike in some others where China usually overshadows India in terms of military and economic might, in this field, in pharmaceuticals, in healthcare, in affordable healthcare especially, India has actually a comparative edge and advantage over China. So I think that will be certainly a subtle message going around that you can depend on us.
New Delhi has also begun commercial shipments of vaccines. The first consignments have reached Brazil and Morocco. More will go to countries in Africa and South America in the coming months. Following New Delhi's approval of the AstraZeneca vaccine and one developed by an Indian company, Modi said this month that India will play a frontline role in providing vaccines.
Today, India, with not one, but two Made in India vaccines, is ready to protect humanity. Being pharmacy of the world, India has supplied essential medicines to the needy across the globe in the past and is doing it today as well.
As Indian companies ramp up production to meet the huge demand, India hopes to raise its global profile by being seen as a country that will help end the pandemic.
It's a lot of this has to do with image. So the vaccine diplomacy is not about concrete, material benefits. It's about image and soft power.
There has been growing criticism of vaccine inequality. While inoculation programs are well underway in wealthy nations, developing countries are struggling to secure supplies. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
The timeline for former U.S. President Donald Trump's impeachment trial has been set. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer made that announcement on Friday.
The House managers will come to read the article of impeachment at 7 p.m. on Monday, January 25th. Members will then be sworn in the next day, Tuesday, January 26th. After that, both the House managers and the defense will have a period of time to draft their legal briefs, just as they did in previous trials. During that period, the Senate will continue to do other business for the American people. Then, once the briefs are drafted, presentation by the parties will commence the week of February the 8th.
But with President Trump no longer in office, what does the Constitution say about holding such a trial? Well, for that answer and more, I spoke with Joel Paul. He's a constitutional law professor at the University of California, Hastings College of the Law.
Well, textually, the Constitution doesn't really say anything about this. It doesn't expressly limit impeachment to current holders of the office of the presidency. And the impeachment article provides explicitly for the Senate to decide whether to bar someone from future office, which suggests there that the framers of the Constitution had in mind the idea that the impeachment would have some lasting effect after removal from office. But we have a couple of historical precedents for this. In the administration of President Tyler, Secretary of State Daniel Webster was investigated for allegedly misappropriating funds, which he had not done. But after he left the administration, some members of Congress sought to impeach him from office. It wasn't successful. And then later in 1876, Ulysses Grant's Secretary of War, William Belknap, was accused of taking kickbacks. And he was impeached and subject to trial in the Senate after he had already resigned from office. The Senate acquitted him. But I think that's a pretty strong precedent for the proposition that you can impeach someone after they leave office. And of course, logically, if you said that a president couldn't be impeached after he left office, that would mean that a president in the lame duck period would essentially be immunized from any kind of impeachment action. He wouldn't be held accountable for any high crimes or treason that he might commit during that period. So for all these reasons, I think most legal scholars would agree that that even after a resignation, impeachment is an appropriate remedy.
But the forthcoming impeachment trial is not the only thing on the president's plate at the moment.
Well, there are a blizzard of ongoing investigations and potential civil and criminal actions against the president. The New York Attorney General and the New York District Attorney are both investigating the president's businesses for possible tax, banking, wire, and insurance fraud. You have the Internal Revenue Service, which is still investigating Mr. Trump allegedly for not paying about $100 million in taxes, which could lead to some kind of legal action there. It's also being looked into by a House committee. And then you've got the U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia, who presumably is now looking into possible charges against the president for incitement to riot under the District of Columbia's laws or incitement to insurrection under federal law. The Atlanta District Attorney, Fannie Willis, is looking into whether the president committed criminal solicitation to commit election fraud. And then in addition to all of these things and the potential legal action the president may face due to the Mueller report, the recent pardons that the president gave, some people have suggested, were in exchange for large campaign contributions the president received. And so that could be another potential legal action for the president. So in addition to all of these possible criminal actions, the president is facing a lawsuit by his niece who alleges that he stole her inheritance. He's facing a number of lawsuits from people who said that they were ripped off by one of the Trump organizations. There are still investigations of the president's inaugural committee, and I suspect that all of this is going to keep the president very, very busy for the foreseeable future.
Joe Paul is a law professor at UC Hastings in San Francisco, California. The heads of three federally funded international broadcasters were abruptly fired late Friday as the Biden administration completed a house cleaning of Donald Trump appointees at the U.S. Agency for Global Media, the overseer of Voice of America. In a press release on Sunday, the U.S. AGM said Acting Chief Executive Officer Kalu Chow replaced the heads of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Radio Free Asia, and the Middle East Broadcasting Networks. The statement said the organizations now have leadership that will promote democracy and other American values abroad. In addition, Acting CEO Chow named new corporate board directors for the three guarantees, replacing the board directors named by former CEO Michael Pack just days before he resigned at President Biden's request on January 20th. And finally, Heather Maxwell, the host of VOA's Music Time in Africa program, recently went to New York to give us a taste of what's coming in 2021.
Yes, I'm in New York. Now, music performance for live audiences continues to be shut down throughout the city, but musicians have been using this time to create new works. And Yakuba Sisoko is a case in point. He is a world-class kora player, a griot, originally from Mali, and he's working on his new album. We can't join him in his recording studio today, though, because of COVID restrictions. However, he's joining us right here in Midtown to give us a taste of what's to come. So, Yakuba, it's nice to see you.
Nice to see you, too.
You've got a new album coming. What's the title?
The title is simply Blessing.
When do you expect that album to come out?
Actually, mid-March or end of March. That's my deadline.
That's your hope. And you have been working on these pieces since this year of COVID shutdown because you have time.
Exactly. Yeah. Because it's hard when you're busy doing my own, performing with different artists, and you don't have a time to. Or you can just do single, but if you have opportunity to make the whole album, just do it.
Yeah. That's kind of a blessing.
It's a blessing. Exactly.
What are you going to play for us today?
Well, I'm playing the very special ones, which is the title of the album itself, Blessing.
Blessing.
Kaduwa unyini kusoro, kaduwa usanuma yini kusoro.
sammarini ko sorbi kaduwa sammarini ko soro lombe janyale lom se balete.
I love that song, and I sing myself blessed in many ways. You know, I brought blessing from my parent back home, and that blessing followed me in America. Living here, I never work. Mm-hmm. Over 20 years, I live here and I only play music. Thank God, that's a blessing.
Yeah.
And I'm doing my own project also. I was selected as a musical explorer teacher at Carnegie Hall. So I'm doing that between here and Savannah, Georgia with my own band. So it's really going well. I feel that I'm really blessed.
And you've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so at voanews.com. I'd also love to hear from you, so please share your thoughts with me on Twitter at It's Steve Miller. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a magnificent Monday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States and Pakistan have created two initiatives to improve health security and disease monitoring in Pakistan. One introduces an innovative method of evaluating the safety and effectiveness of medicine. The other will increase the country's ability to monitor the spread of infectious disease. In early December, the Drug Regulatory Authority of Pakistan, in partnership with the United States Agency for International Development, or USAID, unveiled their new platform for monitoring new medicines in the development and approval processes. The platform, called the Pakistan Integrated Regulatory Information Management System, will help Pakistani companies easily apply for permission to produce a medicine, as well as bring safe and effective medicines to market more quickly at a much lower cost. The program was also created to comply with international pharmaceutical standards, allowing Pakistan to increase its participation in the international market. U.S. and Pakistani government officials also announced the inauguration of 155 district disease monitoring units to improve local health officials' ability to track the spread of infectious diseases such as COVID-19 throughout Pakistan. The United States Agency for International Development supported the training of rapid response teams working in the monitoring units on how to conduct contact tracing for COVID-19 cases. These teams were also trained to use data to identify potential COVID-19 hotspots within the districts, which will improve real-time coordination between the district and provincial levels. The Special Assistant to the Prime Minister on Health, Dr. Faisal Sultan, expressed his gratitude to the United States government and acknowledged that this support will go a long way towards institutionalizing an integrated disease surveillance system in Pakistan. The United States and Pakistan have been at the forefront of this issue, not only through our joint leadership in international initiatives like the Global Health Security Agenda, but also at the country level, working closely with communities. Being able to rapidly monitor, detect, and respond to public health threats such as COVID-19 is critically important. It inspired our partnership with the government of Pakistan to establish these district disease monitoring and response units and build the capacity of nearly 3,000 healthcare workers to rapidly respond to public health threats in Pakistan, said USAID Mission Director Julie Conan. We thank the government of Pakistan for our continued collaboration as we meet the challenge of linking these units to provincial, regional, and federal structures, thereby providing critical resources to stop the spread of COVID-19 and other infectious diseases.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.